So we are going to talk about listening. And, for Julie, sometimes we do clips. I love doing clips. I look for them, and so I have another clip for today. But I want to do it a little differently than I normally do it. I usually start with a clip, and then we talk about it. But this time, I would like to talk a little bit about what happens when we're not using mindfulness in our listening, when we're not Linda was pointing to in the poem. Hold on one second. I was just going to mute Linda so it wouldn't have this echo. So the poem is a perfect example of the generosity that can come from listening. And oftentimes we do not associate listening with speech. Like when we started this month, I was pointing to oftentimes we don't even think about speech. The little clip I showed was the guy with his hands in his pocket, because we walk around with speech all around us, and yet we don't really pay attention to it unless we do some intentional practice around it. Otherwise, it just becomes part of the landscape that we live with. It's the same way with listening. Listening oftentimes is the underlying state in which we're going to speak out of. And so that listening is what we can begin to pay attention to almost before we even get to the listening. So I want to talk a little bit about this kind of non-mindful listening. And then I want to show the clip. And then I want to talk about mindful listening. Because this non-mindful, what I would consider non-mindful, is habit listening. It is this phrase that was coined. I thought it came from Landmark Educations, but somebody told me that it came from somebody in Portugal, and then somebody said, no, it didn't come from someone in Portugal. They took it from somebody in Europe. Anyway, I don't know who coined this phrase, but everybody seems to want to lay claim to it, because it is the perfect example of how we go through life. It's called already always thinking. So we already have a view about something. We always have that view. And that becomes the basis of our thinking. This already always thinking. It shows up in family. It shows up in friends. It shows up when we look at just situations everywhere. We have this preconceived idea of what the experience is. And that is always the way we hold it. And every time that situation shows up, we always look at it in that way. And we already have that kind of expectation. And that kind of way of moving through the world, we cannot see suffering. We can't see the pain of it. We can't see what we're doing. And we can't see the pain that others are pretty much putting on us. When we're listening from that presumptions, we're not in the present moment. We're not in the present moment. We are in our presumptions, our already always thinking. And mindfulness is about being in the present moment. Whatever's going on in the present moment is fine, but it's about being in the present moment. And so learning to pay attention to how we are listening in the world can do a lot to help us. This already always thinking is also pointing to a kind of habit way of moving. It's habitual. So I kept thinking to myself, how could I show us habit? I mean, How can we see habit in that way? It's painful, this habit, way of hearing and speaking. It's painful. There's just no question about it. When we have a preoccupation, even about the way somebody is, then that person has no liberation. And it's not something we do to be harmful. It's something that is harmful. And so how do I show us in a short little dumbette kind of time the pain that we can experience through this non-listening that we have a way of living our lives out of, and contrast that to the kind of listening that Linda brought out in the poem. And so this is the beginning way I wanted to get us started before I showed this clip. Because when we are in this habit energy, we are basically analyzing, evaluating, and judging what it is that we are experiencing. That's what, we're not in the present moment, we're in our evaluation of the present moment, our analyzing of the present moment. And we are moving based on our evaluation and our analysis. Whatever we analyze the moment to be or evaluate the moment to be, that is the way we move in the world. And mindfulness cuts a knife in that and changes that way of moving in the world, such that the way we are moving in the world is much more through the felt sense of this moment and not our analysis of the moment. So I found a clip. Looking for these clips is almost like my secret TV time, because I'm looking for some Donna, some clip, right? So I got to keep watching all these different little clips in order for me to see it. So it's my little sneaky way of watching a lot of TV. But I love it. Anyway, so I found a clip that I think represents this. And so I want to give you a couple of caveats, though. So the clip is about a black man. And it's black and white, so black man and then white people together, men and women. So I want you to see if you can ignore the races. This is not about the races, because we are, each one of us in this room, we are all, every single person in this clip. So you're not the white people and I'm the black people. You are the black man. You are the white woman, you are the white man, you are everybody. We're all of us doing this all day long. We are doing it. As painful as it's painful to watch what we're going to see. It's only 2.5 minutes, but still it's painful. But we are all of this. I want you to notice how casually he takes on this is about giving and receiving labels. So how casually the labels are given and how casually the labels are received until the very last one. And that very last one is what I want to point to, is the distinction between this habit way of listening, of already always thinking, and mindfulness. So at the very end, there's a little bit of a, you know, it's kind of a God-like opening. So, okay, I got that. But what I want us to see is, think of this narrowing moment that you see as the way mindfulness narrows our attention to this present moment. And then you can see what happens. So there's a narrowing of our attention to this present moment. And then we can begin to change how we relate from then on. So let's look at this clip a little minute here. Let me share my screen. It won't take that long. It goes quick, so you do have to pay attention pretty quick. All right, I'm assuming you can see that. Everybody can see that? We're good? Okay. I think that clip points to what I'm trying to point to. I love that clip, the way they zoomed in on his face at the very end. And you could tell that he was feeling whatever that label was, right? So there's a moment where you're present to it, feeling. Otherwise, the labeling is just kind of like they were just passing him out. Oh, yeah, you did something. Boom, that's who you are. And then he was just taking them and putting them on. We all do that. That's what we do. We walk through life. People just give us labels and we just, I don't know if this fits me, but okay, I'll stick that one on. Okay, this is who I am. This is what speech does when it's habitual, when it's evaluative and analyzing. It just pokes at us and we just take it and walk around with it. The reason why I think this points to mindfulness is because it was such a distinction between just the taking of labels and this, that last label of actually feeling it, of being with it, of narrowing in to this moment and what we feel. This is what I think mindfulness is trying to point to. This is what I think Buddha was trying to point to. Because if we don't narrow our view to the present moment, we don't know that we're carrying unnecessary suffering. We are just dragging it around. It would have been better if those labels were not just little tags or little labels. It would have been better if the labels were chains, because that's what these labels do to us. If he was dragging around the chains, you would begin to see how weighted a lot of the way we speak to each other and speak to ourselves, what's actually happening is this weightedness that's happening. So when we talk about right speech, and we talk about it either from the listening or from the speaking itself, the giving of the label or the receiving of that label, that right speech is trying to cultivate wise attention in the moment. Our practice is not to say the right thing, even though the last label was love. From a Buddhist perspective, any one of those labels, he could have taken it and in that moment felt into the truth of it and discarded most of that, right? He could have just let it go. He didn't have to take it. So it's not, oh, you can only say nice things like, oh, you're loved. That's not what I was pointing to. What I'm pointing to is in that moment, in that label, he paid attention. And he looked at it and he felt into the truth of it. That's what we're trying to do. And the more I spend time with Philip Moffitt, the more I think his way of approaching the Dhamma is the best cultivation of mindfulness, because he uses both the felt sense of the moment and this kind of non-judging awareness. It's true that when we begin to employ the felt sense and our non-judging awareness to a moment, what we mostly feel is suffering. And we mostly feel the suffering because we're not used to seeing it and feeling it. But when we get used to seeing it and feeling it, our level of sensitivity gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And we can feel suffering at a much lower level. We can feel it before it even grabs a hold of us. We can feel it before the chain even gets dropped off. We can feel it. We know it. And we're comfortable enough not to pick the chain up. There was a really famous sutta where somebody came to the Buddha. I think I've told you guys about this. He talked mad stuff about the Buddha all the time. And he had all these followers, and he was really a famous teacher, and he was always talking mad crap about the Buddha and who he was and blah, 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 blah. So he came to the Buddha's giving a Dhamma talk at some point, and he came, and even while the Buddha was giving his Dhamma talk, he just walked in and, you know, was rude, disrespectful, didn't have any degree of respect, and kind of came up to, you know, like, I need to question you about something, and very disrespectful. Anyway, so the Buddha, I wish I could remember exactly what he said. I hate it when suttas just come to me and I can't remember. But the Buddha looked at him and was saying, asking him, he wanted to ask some question of the Buddha. And he goes, you know, so what do you mean when you do that? And the Buddha asked him, went in a completely different direction, said, if somebody, you know, were to offer you, I don't know, some, you know, some terrible thing, would you take it? And the guy's like, no, I wouldn't take that. That's not a gift. And so the Buddha said, so I am not taking what you're offering, and I'm giving you your gift back. And then he just kind of turned and went back to his Dhamma talk. It was sort of like, I'm not taking it. That is what we are trying to do. We're not trying to be nice. We're trying to know when suffering is present and when suffering is not present. We're trying to be wise enough to know when suffering is present, can I uncling to that suffering? Can I let go of whatever I'm clinging to free myself from it? Speech is the way that we do that. So we can do this if we listen from the felt sense and a non-judging awareness of the present moment. When we listen this way, when we listen with kindness, a kind of caring interest in the moment. It doesn't mean that our speech will always be nice and never angry. What it means is that if we notice our speech has gone awry, that's when we come into the present moment and we let go of that clinging and make that adjustment. So the felt sense of suffering becomes the gauge that helps us find our way. It means listening to what we're saying to ourselves, what we're saying to other people, what we're listening into, what we're allowing other people to say. It means all of that, our basic listening. And for me, this asking, is this that I'm listening to going to support my continued mindfulness? And that's why I can listen to clips all the time, watch all these clips, because I'm always listening for the Dhamma. I can't watch movies now without listening for the Dhamma in it, you know. I'm like, that's like a Dhamma talk. Somebody told me, if you have never seen the three Kung Fu Panda movies, then that's your homework. You got to watch the three Kung Fu Panda. This monk told me those are not entertainment. Those are Dhamma talks. So you got to watch them because they unfold in this understanding of the panda's understanding from his habit energy into being this powerful being. Awakening is what it is. His awakening. And so you can see this progression in these three movies. So they're not movies. They're Dhamma talks. Anyway, let me see if there's something else. Yeah, I think this is it. I'll see what you guys want to think about, and then we'll have plenty of time to be able to reject the rejection. Yes, that's good. It's a I just want to add with this reject the rejection. You got to feel that rejection, right? So you got to know that is a rejection because you feel the pain of that rejection. And then you're rejecting it. It's not just, I assume that is a rejection and that's why I'm rejecting it. It's that, that's habit energy. And the feeling it as, this is a rejection. Yeah, I'm giving that right back. I don't really need it. All right. So I want to give those of you a moment to be able to say goodbye while I begin to set up these groups. And we'll take about 10 minutes in a group. I'm just going to put us in a group of, I guess three, because some of you have two people. Actually, no, I think I'm just going to put you in groups of two and give us 10 minutes so we can kind of come back from the clip and have time to share. All right, I think we're all back, and I'm going to send this clip since several of you asked for it, and that's the link to it. So how did this land for you, this thinking about listening as a way of, understanding speech more fully? Yeah, go ahead, either Sean or Bruce.
Bruce. It's interesting. My reaction to the clip was that it's nothing new. That it's much easier to believe and accept the negative thoughts, and how difficult it is to really accept that I'm loved.
Yes.
Because I was telling the person I met with, I've never talked to her before. She was very interesting. So thank you for putting us together.
No problem.
I think I love her. I might marry her.
That's right. She's a keeper.
So the times that probably for plus 45 years, I've been attempting to love myself and be kind to myself. And I'll go and have different little exercises where I take, do all this stuff and treat my little boy a certain way. And it always goes away, and it goes back to beating shit out of myself.
Yeah.
So it's interesting observing that.
Yeah, because the thing that I really wanted to point to is when we just take on these labels without really feeling it, we don't realize what we're doing to ourselves.
Yeah.
And actually, the felt sense of suffering is how you begin to let go of that suffering and actually feel into the truth that you are loved. We can't feel the truth of we are loved because we won't let ourselves feel the pain of some of these labels. Yeah. And in order to feel the love, we got to learn to feel that suffering and let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another thing I noticed during the meditation was I started thinking about internal listening, and then I asked myself, is there anything I'm not listening to?
Oh, there you go.
And one of the things that came forward was like, when I'm grumpy, you beat the shit out of me. But really what I'm trying to tell you is I'm hurting and I need something.
Yep.
Or when my back hurts, I make it my fault. There's something wrong with me. How about some compassion here? So internal listening is really beyond, deeper than the mind chatter, is really, really, really important.
Yes, it is. Great, Bruce. Those two points were what I was hoping if people left with, they would understand that learning to listen to yourself deeply can be the first place to start listening, is to start listening in with your internal chatter. And when you start listening there, you can start listening outside of you. But that, and this knowing that we can't take in that love if we don't learn to take, to really get how painful these labels are. It really is.
That's a key, to get, to really get how painful the labels are. Yeah.
That's right. And you can tell, I mean, when the guy spilled the sugar, it was just a momentary thing. That doesn't make him clumsy. It's a momentary thing, but we label it as it's a permanent fact. That's what you are.
Yeah.
And so that's the pain of it. Great.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, you can't give what you don't have, which is true. And I think that's what this whole practice is pointing towards. Is this a hand up again, Sean? Is this you? Or is that the same hand? That's the same hand. Okay. Anybody else? I know it's deep here, and you don't have to say anything. So I don't want to create some place where you feel like you have to speak into the depth of it. I know it's deep. That's why I wanted to talk first, then show the clip, and then have a talk about Dhamma. Well, let me share some things then, since no one has their hand up. So I notoriously came from trauma. And that meant I came from a lot of judgment and a lot of evaluation. That's all my family did. I was in a training recently, and I realized that my parents had this evaluation around being an unwed mother. Oh, my God. If my father or my mother just suspected somebody was an unwed mother, they would just go on this tirade about how terrible and awful unwed mothers were. And I didn't realize it. I mean, I got married when I was very young. And then I got pregnant. But I'm not an unwed mother because I'm married, right? But we got a divorce like a year after the baby was born. And I never made the connection for a lot of the weight that I carried around in my 20s and my 30s about being an unwed mother. And all of that weight came from the labeling I was giving myself about it, being on welfare, all of the drama I went through, all of the negativity was mostly my carrying the weight of my parents' judgment from when I was growing up. We carry that all the time. And there's a part of us, I think, that fears the pain of that, because there's this, you know, like there's a truth in it, right? I am unwed mother. That truth of it is what I think we fear more than anything else. But that is the beauty of mindfulness, because mindfulness brings us into the present moment. And in the present moment, you can never really live out of a label. A label is way too permanent. So in the present moment, that label may have some truth to it, which is, I'm an unwed mother. That's right. I was unwed and I was a mother. But in the present moment, I was also a law student who was a single parent putting herself through law school, right? And that carries a level of integrity and honor and respect. But it's still the same energy. But in the present moment, you have what I think Lindo's poem was pointing to, is you have way more generosity. You have way more available to you in the present moment than the label itself. And we live out of labels. And that's what's killing us. So I know at one point Lauren, towards the end, is going to, I think the last week, Lauren's going to point to some practices. but two practices that have saved me from my own thinking is nonviolent communication from Marshall Rosenberg and Greg Kramer's Inside Dialogue. Both of those practices bring mindfulness into the present moment. They bring mindfulness into the present moment because they keep pointing us to this felt sense moment of our experience. And I am grateful to Marshall Rosenberg and grateful to Greg Kramer for those two practices, because most of my capacity to deal with pain and be with discomfort comes from the practices I did with those two. It comes from spending many, many, many hours trying to figure out what was my feeling and my need in some given moment when I feel just pissy or grumpy or whatever, trying to figure out what that was. And it comes from this relational practice of having a relationship with my own body to listen deeply to what was going on for me. And those two things really changed the way I related to present moment. So I'm going to call it quits here. And if no one has anything else to say, so we can turn to do the announcements. But I think it's probably better if we, I don't know, it feels painful enough here that we take a moment to be silent. It feels just enough level of pain that I think we need to be silent first before we go to the announcements. And Linda, I'll make you the host. And then you can go as long as you want.
Let me see if I can find a poem.
Here it is. Yeah, maybe this poem. So let's sit for a little bit and then I'll read the poem. This is called The Cure by Albert Huffstickler. We think we get over things. We don't get over things. Or say we get over the measles, but not a broken heart. We need to make that distinction. The things that become part of our experience never become less part of our experience. So how can I say it? The way to get over a life is to die. Short of that, you move with it. Let the pain be pain, not in the hope that it will vanish, but in the faith that it will fit in, find its place in the shape of things, and be not any less pain, but true to form. Because anything natural has an inherent shape and will flow towards it. And a life is as natural as a leaf. That's what we're looking for. Not the end of a thing, but the shape of it. Wisdom is seeing the shape of your life without obliterating or getting over a single instance of it. Okay, Linda. Thank you.